The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Good morning, Glory America. Bonjour, hi, Canada. Rabbit on July 1, 2021. I am Hugh Hewitt inside the Beltway. We lost a great American yesterday. Donald Rumsfeld died at the age of 88. And he was genuinely a great American. The youngest Secretary of Defense ever. He returned to the Pentagon, and with George W. Bush and Dick Cheney, Condoleezza Rice and Colin Powell, they oversaw the response to 9/11, got a stricken United States back on its feet, deterred any future attack on the United States, reorganized the Pentagon, and endured. Donald Rumsfeld, the great American, dead at the age of 88. He was often a guest on this program. And today on the interview with Hugh Hewitt, I will replay in full an interview from 2011 on his memoir. And tomorrow on the interview with Hugh Hewitt, that's my podcast, I will replay an interview from 2013 when the former Secretary of Defense joined me to discuss his famous book, Rumsfeld's Rules. Those will both be posted at the interview with Hugh Hewitt. But a couple of excerpts from those interviews to begin today. Donald Rumsfeld with me on the 22nd of February 2011 when his memoir, Known Unknowns, came out.
Your assistant secretary for public affairs at the Pentagon, Tory Clark, turns to you at the end of 9/11, the longest day probably in your many years of public service, and asks, have you called Mrs. R? And you said you had not through that long day. And assistant secretary Clark had some choice words for you, but you don't tell me what Joyce, you don't tell the reader what Joyce said to you when you finally did connect with
her. Joyce said that I finally got home, you know, after 11 at night and told her what Tory had said, and she laughed, and she adored Tory Clark. And she said that it never crossed her mind that I would call her. And she said she knew where I was. She knew what I was doing. She knew I was busy. And I knew where she was. She was at the Defense Intelligence Agency with a number of the defense attachés from around the world. And I can well understand Tory's as a spouse, finding it quite natural, but as Secretary of Defense, when our country had been attacked and there were people in our building that were dying and being pulled out of the burning building, it was the last thing in my mind.
Now, I happen to have had the great honor of meeting Mrs. Rumsfeld a number of times. I interviewed the Secretary of Defense at the Nixon Library in person, and he was back again. On both occasions, I interviewed him, and on both occasions got to meet Mrs. Rumsfeld, and she's just a joy. They're both Midwesterners at heart. He's from Illinois. In fact, his first job in government was as a legislative assistant to Congressman David Denny Dennison, who represented Warren, Ohio. So he actually knew a lot about Warren and Mrs. Rumsfeld, and the Fetching Mrs. Hewitt got along so well. Our friend Donna, I can remember them sitting there in the front row as we talked. Rummy liked nothing better than to catch you in an error. And we got along fine, but if you got something wrong about his book, he let you know it in no uncertain terms. He was really quite remarkable. He came to the studio a couple of years later when Rumsfeld's Rules came out. Keith Urban, the wonder agent with Javelin in Washington, D.C., had got him to finally write down Rumsfeld's Rules, and he came back to the West Coast, and he joined me in studio. Here's a clip of that, cut 19.
Explain to people what you mean by A's pick A's and B's pick C's.
Well, for whatever reason, A's understand what quality is, and they seek it out, and they attract them. And B's sometimes really are a little worried about having an A around because they might outshine them. So B's tend to hire B's or C's, and the difference is enormous. One time I had a daughter come to me and say, gee, what do you think I ought to do? Or what business or what industry or what state or where should, what company? I said, it doesn't matter. Go to work with someone who's brilliant. And you'll find that he sparkles, he or she, and that the people around them will sparkle. And she said, well, like who? And I said, well, Herman Kahn or Bill Buckley. Just find somebody in a field you're interested in who is really smart. And what do you do for them? She said. And I said, doesn't matter what you do for them. Be around them. Meet the people they are around. Yeah. Because A's attract A's.
You know, you just mentioned a name, Herman Kahn, which our audience will not recognize. But when I went to work as a young man for Richard Nixon, everything Herman Kahn wrote was hanging around San Clemente because he was the first great futurist. Tell people about Herman Kahn.
Well, he became a dear friend. When I was in Congress in the 1960s, we used to go to conferences together. And we've traveled to Japan together and what have you. And he was the person who was dealing very knowledgeably. He was a futurist, I guess. He wrote back in the 1960s, he wrote the year 2000, which then was decades ahead. Yeah. And it was a fascinating thing. He founded the Hudson Institute. He was very knowledgeable about thermonuclear war and the risks and the dangers and the concepts of deterrence.
A serious man, a wise man, a funny man, and a thoroughgoing patriot, Donald Rumsfeld, dead at the age of 88. He and his friend Dick Cheney also represent the sort of highest form of friendship that Aristotle talked about when equals of ability become simply partners in the public good. Wonderful, wonderful man. Both of those interviews will play in their entirety at The Interview with Hugh Hewitt, my podcast. Later today, we'll post one. Tomorrow, we'll post the second. More on Rumsfeld a little bit later. The headlines in the rundown here. The heat wave caused at least 76 deaths in Oregon and Washington. It was tragic. If you don't have air conditioning in a sudden, extraordinary heat wave, up to 115 in Portland hits. Many people die, including especially old people who are not prepared, are not looking, and do not have regular help. The federal judge blocked Governor DeSantis's new law that would penalize social media companies. Governor DeSantis announced he is, of course, disappointed by Judge Hinkle's ruling and will appeal it to the United States Court of Appeals for the 11th Circuit. It'll be interesting to me. I have some qualms. But it's a new area of the law. Normally, viewpoint discrimination, content discrimination, unconstitutional under the First Amendment. But it is the providers who are themselves, I think, government actors in one sense, who are doing the discriminating in the first instance. And the government is correcting that. It'll be a case of first impression. Amazon, in which I am a shareholder, I always note that, had a great quarter. And they topped it off by seeking the recusal of FTC Chairwoman Lina Khan in an antitrust investigation. If you're a lawyer like me, you run through the end of the argument. You stay all the way to the end. It's a good argument. 25 pages. I've linked it online at my Twitter account, at Hugh Hewitt, just to see who are their lawyers. And they hired, of course, Covington and Burling and Williams and Connolly. Because it's always which one or the other. Are you going to hire Covington? Are you going to hire Williams and Connolly? Because they're the two greatest firms in America. And I mean, if you're on the West Coast, you might hire Larson. But, you know, and I work for Aaron Fox. I've got no dog in this, son. I love Aaron Fox. I was a partner there, too. But never worked for Covington or Williams and Connolly. I worked for Gibson Dunn. I worked for lots of great firms. But when you look at the end of the Amazon brief and they've hired the two best firms, I say to myself, this is not going to be a one-round, 15-round, or 45-round, three-round, three-fight fight. It's going to go on forever. Jeff Bezos doesn't mess around. Trump Organization and its CFO are expected to be charged today. Tax evasion. That's what got Al Capone. Don't laugh it off. It's serious business. Iran. This is in the Times of Israel. Iran has told its negotiators to tell the United States that they will only do a new deal if the United States agrees never to withdraw from it. To which I say, way to go, Iran. That means a treaty. The only way you can condition something even, and that can be broken as well, but the only thing that gets close is a treaty. And any deal with Iran is a treaty and should be submitted to the United States Senate as a treaty. And that's what should have happened long ago when the horrible JCPOA was passed. If they had done a treaty then, we would not have gotten this terrible deal then, and they should do it now. Donald Trump visited the Texas border with Governor Greg Abbott in Texas yesterday. Here's what he said, cut number one.
We're going over to the border right now, but we're going to the real part of the border where there's real problems, not a part where you look around and you don't see anybody. We're going to admire the wall and how it works, because wherever we have the wall, that's what made the big difference. It made tremendous difference. And I just want to thank the people in this room. You have been incredible, incredible partners, including those characters back there that are all friends of mine. Every single one. Good job on television yesterday morning.
The president, the former president is back talking about the current vice president. We'll play more of that coming up. That's the rundown this morning. R.I.P. Donald Rumsfeld. I'm Hugh Hewitt. Inside the Beltway, stay with us. Welcome back, America, on this 1st of July. Donald Rumsfeld is famous for many things. Before Donald Trump, there was Newt Gingrich in the 2012 campaign, demonstrating hostility to the media and confrontation with the media. But before there was Newt Gingrich, there was Donald Rumsfeld, demonstrating command of the media. Most famous for his combination of command and concise knowledge and the ability to frame the issue is this cut, which is his most famous response to a question.
There are reports that there is no evidence of a direct link between Baghdad and some of these terrorist organizations.
There are known knowns. There are things we know we know. We also know there are known unknowns. That is to say, we know there are some things we do not know. But there are also unknown unknowns. The ones we don't know, we don't know.
Excuse me, but is this an unknown unknown?
I'm not.
Several unknowns, and I'm just wondering.
I'm not going to say which it is.
Mr. Secretary,
I'm right here.
See, Rumsfeld knew exactly what he was doing. It makes perfect sense, and that's why his memoir is known as Known Unknowns. But for the full tutorial on how to deal with the media, here is a press situation with Donald Rumsfeld on April the 11th, 2003. Listen to how he deals with a hostile press.
This is Bill. And are U.S. troops capable of or inclined to be police forces on the ground?
Well, I think the way to think about that is that if you go from a repressive regime that has, it's a police state, where people are murdered and imprisoned by the tens of thousands. And then you go to something other than that, a liberated Iraq, that you go through a transition period. And in every country in my adult lifetime that's had the wonderful opportunity to do that, to move from a repressed dictatorial regime to something that's freer, we've seen in that transition period there's untidiness. And there's no question but that that's not anyone's choice. On the other hand, if you think of those pictures, very often the pictures are pictures of people going into the symbols of the regime, into the palaces, into the boats, and into the Ba'ath Party headquarters, and into the places that have been part of that repression. And while no one condones looting, on the other hand, one can understand the pent-up feelings that may result from decades of repression and people who've had members of their family killed by that regime, for them to be taking their feelings out on that regime. With respect to the second part of your question, we do feel an obligation to assist in providing security, and the coalition forces are doing that. They're patrolling in various cities where they see looting. They're stopping it. And they will be doing so. The second step, of course, is to not do that on a permanent basis, but rather to find Iraqis who can assist in providing police support in those cities and various types of stabilizing and security assistance. And we're in the process of doing that.
But
in answer to your direct answer to your question, are we concerned that this would offset it? The feeling of liberation suggests that, gee, maybe they were better off repressed. And I don't think there's anyone in any of those pictures or any human being who's not free who wouldn't prefer to be free and recognize that you pass through a transition period like this and accept it as part of the price of getting from a repressed regime to a freedom.
Charlie, the other point I think to make is that it's uneven throughout the country. In the South, where we've been for some time, where the clerics have been speaking out against looting and for civil order, where some of the Iraqi citizens themselves are saying, let's don't loot and that sort of thing, that actually the situation is pretty good. In Qusar, it's in good shape. In Basra, it's looting has been going down over time as we track it. So as we go up from the South, it's getting better and better for obvious reasons. So
let me say one other thing. The images you are seeing on television, you are seeing over and over and over, and it's the same picture of some person walking out of some building with a vase, and you see it 20 times, and you think, my goodness, were there that many vases? is it possible that there were that many vases in the whole country?
The words anarchy and lawlessness are ill-chosen.
Absolutely. I picked up a newspaper today, and I couldn't believe it. I read 8 headlines that talked about chaos, violence, unrest, and it just was henny penny. The sky is falling. I've never seen anything like it. And here is a country that's being liberated. Here are people who are going from being repressed and held under the thumb of a vicious dictator, and they're free. And all this newspaper could do with 8 or 10 headlines, they showed a man bleeding, a civilian who they claimed we had shot, one thing after another. It's just unbelievable how people can take that away from what is happening in that country. Do I think those words are unrepresentative? Yes.
Mr. Secretary, could I follow that up?
Sure. I think it deserves a follow-up.
You seem ready for the survey.
Let's go get that newspaper.
I think the question is, if a foreign military force came into your neighborhood and did away with the police and left you at the mercy of criminals, how long would you feel liberated?
Well, that's a fair question. First of all, the foreign military force came into their neighborhood and did not do away with any police. There may have been some police who fled because the people didn't like them and because they'd been doing things to the people in the local community that the people wanted to have a word with them about. But we haven't gone in and done away with any police. In fact, we're looking for police in those villages and towns who can, in fact, assist in providing order to the extent there are people who can do it in a manner that's consistent with our values.
Well, we'll follow up to that when he's finished.
Let me follow up mine.
I'll follow up his follow up if I may.
Maybe not.
Given how predictable the lack of law and order was, as you said, from past conflict. Was there part of General Frank's plan to deal with it? And perhaps, what is it?
This is fascinating.
This is just fascinating.
From the very beginning, we were convinced that we would succeed. And that means that that regime would end. And we were convinced that as we went from the end of that regime to something other than that regime, there would be a period of transition. And you cannot do everything instantaneously. It's never been done, everything instantaneously. We did, however, recognize that there was at least a chance of catastrophic success, if you will, to reverse the phrase, that you could in a given place or places have a victory that occurred well before reasonable people might have expected it, and that we needed to be ready for that. We needed to be ready with medicine, with food, with water, and we have been. And you say, well, what was it in the plan? The plan is a complex set of conclusions or ideas that then have a whole series of alternative excursions that one can do depending on what happens. And they have been doing that as they've been going along. And they've been doing a darn good job.
Mr. Secretary, I'm asking, what plan was there to restore law and order?
Well, let's just take a city. To take the port city, Qusar. What the plan was? Well, the British went in. They built a pipeline bringing water in from Kuwait. They cleared the mine of ports. They brought ships in with food. They've been providing security. In fact, they've done such a lousy job that the city has gone from 15,000 to 40,000. Now, think of that.
Why would people vote with their feet and go into this place that's so bad? The reason they're going in is because there's food, there's water, there's medicine, and there's jobs. That's why. The British have done a fantastic job. They've done an excellent job. And does that mean you couldn't go in there and take a television camera or get a still photographer and take a picture of something that was imperfect, untidy? I could do that in any city in America. Think what's happened in our cities when we've had riots and problems and looting. Stuff happens. But in terms of what's going on in that country, it is a fundamental misunderstanding to see those images over and over and over again of some boy walking out with a vase and say, oh, my goodness, you didn't have a plan. That's nonsense. They know what they're doing, and they're doing a terrific job, and it's untidy, and freedom's untidy, and free people are free to make mistakes and commit crimes and do bad things. They're also free to live their lives and do wonderful things, and that's what's going to happen here.
Mr. Secretary.
Hang on over here.
About my follow-up, Mr. Secretary.
There's some additional specificity here. While you have just expressed yet again your dismay at the international news media, in fact, the reporting does factually show there are some certain number of Iraqi citizens that have spoken on camera quite directly about their own concerns about the safety and security in Baghdad and that situation. There have also been absolutely verified reports that it is not just regime targets, but indeed hospitals, banks, other facilities essential to society. The ICRC has been on TV today saying that hospitals are being looted, not regime targets they're speaking of, and that they can't even get there to resupply these essential hospitals. Now, my question is, General Brooks said this morning that the military, U.S. military did not want to reconstruct the Iraqi police force in Baghdad because the feeling of the U.S. military was that that Iraqi police force had been operating against the U.S. military. He didn't feel that was a secure solution. So with some specificity, what type of Iraqi force can you bring to bear in Baghdad to have Iraqis help restore security? And what types of specific tasks are you now going to assign the U.S. military to do to help restore the situation which the people of Baghdad appear to be concerned about?
Hospitals. Well, let's go back to what you said about people. You could take a camera and a microphone and stick it in front of 1,000 people in Iraq today, and you could find someone saying every single thing you've said and every single thing I've said. You're going to find it all across the spectrum. You know, it's the facts on the ground where a person is that determines how they feel about it. And there are some very dangerous places in that country and some very difficult situations. And there is no question, but there is a hospital that was looted. There also is this fact. The Saddam Hussein regime and the Ba'ath Party put their headquarters in hospitals all over that country. They have been doing it systematically. Have we been complaining about that? Have we been photographing that? Have we been bemoaning that? No.
Donald Rumsfeld was speaking on April the 11th. 40 days later, the worst decision in the Iraq war, not to invade, but the decision to disband the Iraqi army was made by Ambassador Paul Bremer, the head of the Coalition Provisional Authority, and more chaos came. 4,500 Americans lost their lives in Iraq in uniform, thousands more contractors, tens of thousands wounded. It remains a controversial subject. I will discuss it with Ambassador Michael Oren today, former Senator Jim Talent. I'll be talking about it with Senator Tom Cotton, who served in Iraq. But Rumsfeld was a great Secretary of Defense. Let me move to my relieffactor.com endorsement and my daily take of it. Out yesterday in the ridiculous 97 degree heat, but nevertheless, relieffactor.com got me through it. Take my pills in the morning, every morning, and relieffactor.com is what you ought to take every day on a long weekend, especially. I know some of you are leaving today and making it a 4-day weekend to celebrate the 4th of July. But take your relieffactor.com with you, or go and order it today and get it tomorrow and take it with you tomorrow. I'll be right back on the Hugh Hewitt Show. Welcome
Welcome back, America. I'm Hugh Hewitt, joined by Ambassador Michael Oren, former ambassador to the United States from Israel. I assume Michael Oren in his long career had to deal with Donald Rumsfeld. I don't know for sure. Dr. Oren, good morning. How are you? And did you, in fact, have a relationship with Donald Rumsfeld?
I did. And good morning to you, too, Hugh. I did, but not in his defense capacity. Later, after his retirement, he established the Rumsfeld Fund, which supported very important research in my field of international relations, the Middle Eastern studies. He was extremely generous, and he was enabled several of my best students.
Are you in, like, Galilee somewhere? Are you in a bunker? Because your phone is terrible there, Dr. Oren. So I'm not sure what the Rumsfeld Fund did. I'm curious if you had interaction with him and what you thought about him in retirement.
At retirement, I think he was the Amenons Greece. He was a senior statesman, a very pleasant individual, very generous individual. All my interactions with him were very positive.
Now, the question that I have goes back to the disbanding, and you're in the region. The major error the United States made in Iraq, one, believing there were weapons of mass destruction, but that was a universally made and held error. But number two, disbanding the Iraqi army with which Rumsfeld had nothing to do, but Ambassador Paul Bremer's decision. What do you make of the decision to abandon the Iraqi army and dissolve it in May of 2003?
Well, there were a number of very bad decisions. The only worst decision in getting into Iraq was getting out of Iraq. Okay, you can say.
2012, yeah, 11, yeah.
Yeah, I think that was a huge mistake. But I'm in a unique position, too, because I actually testified against the Iraq war back in 2003 to the House Committee on Foreign Relations and made a lot of enemies with some of my very good friends who were very in favor of the war, sort of the neocons were very in favor of the war. But my rationale was not left or right. It was just my sense was, you know, the British had tried this. They lost their stomach for it. The French had tried it. They lost their stomach for it. My recommendation to the United States is don't get involved in state making in the Middle East. You're going to get tired. You're going to go home. And my fear was, and I said this to Congress, that in the wake of the American withdrawal from Iraq, that the Iranian border would move 800 miles westward toward Israel. And I'm just, you know, very, very sorry to say that I was spot on with that. I'm not a prophet, but I think that was clear that this was going to happen. So I don't hold Donald Rumsfeld responsible. There were many, many people, many Democrats who were in favor of that war and disagree with me.
Would the world be better off if Saddam was still in power, which is possible given it would just depend on whether or not he had a lifespan this long, 20 years after the fact, or is Iraq better off with a Shia majority government and a free Kurdistan?
Well, the Shia majority government is also now very much under the thumb of Iran, and so it's not better off, as some of the rocket attacks on American bases have demonstrated. And we assume in our next war with Iran that we'll be hit by rockets from Iraq, not just from Iran and not just from Syria and Lebanon and Gaza, from Iraq. So obviously it wasn't in our interest, in Israel's interest, and I think by association, not in America's interest. My recommendation to Congress back in 2003 was, you know, you want to go in and kill Saddam Hussein, be my guest. Kill him. Blow up his palaces. We can do the same thing to his sons as far as I'm concerned. The message should go out to the Middle East that nobody, how should we say this on public radio, no one messes around with the United States of America. And there's a price to be paid. But I said, kill him and then get out. Don't stay there. And then maybe another Sunni strongman would have come in and, you know, would have been better off. I think the message would have gotten across the Middle East that no one does mess with the United States of America. And then you'd still have a Sunni conservative, largely secular government in Iraq, which would serve.
You know, there were a number of reactions after Iraq, Michael. One of those was Gaddafi gave up his nukes. He was afraid. Assad went quiet for a long time, and Iran disbanded for a time their nuclear processing. They returned it all after the threat of invasion. Was the problem America didn't go far enough?
Well, that's true, yes. That was always the problem. It was a problem back in 1991, too, if you remember. But
yes.
I think now it's boomerang. Why is it boomerang? The Iranian regime is committed, determined to get a nuclear weapon. It's determined to get a nuclear weapon because, you know, they say to themselves, you know, the Pakistanis have one, the Iraq, Iraqis have, the Indians have one. You know, reports are that the Israelis have one. You know, it can't be a situation that the Iranian regime doesn't have one. We have to have it. But they also noticed what happened to Gaddafi when he gave up his bomb. What happened to Saddam Hussein if his program was bombed? What happened? What doesn't happen to North Korea? So the Iranian regime has taken a lesson from the Iraq war, which is the opposite of what we what people wanted. We wanted them to get deterred. In fact, they have been animated to rush to get this bomb so they don't meet the same fate as Gaddafi and Saddam Hussein.
Hey, quick unrelated question. What is the status of an Iranian biological weapons regime? Have they seen the impact of COVID and delved into that world?
I don't know. They have failed appallingly in their battle against COVID. It's one of many, many failures. They, for whatever reason, the level of infections in Iran have just been the highest in the entire region. And many thousands of people have died. You think the Iranian people would draw some conclusions, huh?
You would. You would. Dr. Michael Oren, thank you. I know as an American-born Israeli, you'll be celebrating a little bit of the 4th of July. Have a great weekend, and stay tuned to America Hour 2 coming up on the Hugh Hewitt Show. Welcome back, America. I'm Hugh Hewitt, joined by former senator, former member of the House, Jim Talent. Jim, Secretary Rumsfeld died yesterday. You knew him well. Senator, what do you think of him?
Well, it's always a loss. When somebody who loved the country as he did was such a distinguished statesman and public servant, when he dies, I mean, you feel it. I think Rumsfeld had tremendous strengths. He was extremely smart. He was a fighter. He was confident. And he was much more personable, I think, than people realize. And so when he got it right, and he got it right a lot of the time, he produced really good results. Now, the downside of that, because everybody's strength is their weakness, right, that when he missed something, it was hard to convince him. And in retrospect, we needed to get more troops on the ground in Iraq a couple years before we did, because we were dealing with not just one insurgency, but a number of them. And that's, you have to do that. You have to have security on the ground in order to deal with it. And I think Rumsfeld came a little too late to that understanding.
We are also marking the 100th anniversary today of the Chinese Communist Party, the biggest threat to freedom in the world. He did not initiate any pivot to Asia, even though he fought. He was a Navy pilot, right? He's a fighter pilot. He ought to have known the supremacy of the air and the sea, but he did not put that forward during his tenure, his second tenure as Secretary of Defense, because obviously there were wars in Afghanistan and Iraq. Was that a blind spot for him, or did we just lack the resources?
That was a blind spot for everybody, and we're all bear some responsibility for that. I said that in a column before the election when I was talking about the failures of those days. That's when we built the littoral combat vessel, which says everything, right? We're so focused on terrorism that we're buying a ship that's effective in littoral waters. Right? When the Chinese are building this blue water Navy. Now, we're still early in the game in terms of their buildup. But yeah, I mean, that was another issue. Can I give you a quote? It's one of my favorites. I think about it at times like this in Churchill's tribute to Chamberlain, what he said about when you reflect on the life of a great man.
Please.
He said, "History with its flickering lamp stumbles along the trail of the past, trying to reconstruct its scenes, revive its echoes, and kindle with pale gleams the passion of former days." Isn't that beautiful?
It is. I believe in that. Churchill also said about Chamberlain's critics, of whom he had been one, that at the time of the death, they are like dogs barking at the bones of a great lion.
Exactly.
Right? Is that not the same speech?
Yeah, his not in the same speech. His tribute to Chamberlain, I think, is the best short speech anybody's ever given. It's just so beautiful. And you think about it, when great men, and Rumsfeld was a great man, you know, when they pass, because they had an impact. And Rumsfeld was a fighter. He was good at getting his way in Washington. And anybody who thinks that's easy, just reflect on the last couple of administrations. But you're right. I mean, I think all of us, we missed for too long the rise of China and the implications of it. And we've been trying to play catch up ever since.
Now, Jim, one of the things I noted in my interview with him, and it posted over at the interview with Hugh Hewitt, I believe, about his memoir. There are two of them. I'm posting one today and one about Rumsfeld's rules. I asked him the biggest change between the Pentagon that he assumed control over under President Ford and the one he took over under President Bush. And he said, and I almost a direct quote, there were 10,000 lawyers in the building the second time I got there. He really did not like the legalization of the conduct of war. And in that regard, that's not about the treaties, the Geneva treaties. It's not a he was always adamant that people understand that Gitmo was not under his control and the torture had nothing to do with him. But he just did not like lawyers fly-specking the conduct of war, that it was simply not possible to do so. Do you agree, disagree? What do you think?
I basically agree. Yeah, I think this is true in national security too much across the board. I think we've tried to substitute legal accountability for political accountability. And when you do that too much, now you have to have basic rules. I mean, the troops have to have guidance, you got to have the Army manual and interrogation, all that. But when you try and substitute lawyers for political accountability, you end up with neither, really. We see it in the intelligence world today. I mean, we've had a breakdown of political accountability and legal accountability, like with the FISA warrants and the rest of it. So there's really no substitute for having good people in charge and holding them accountable without being vindictive about it.
Jim Tell, thank you for that. Donald Rumsfeld, dead at the age of 88, a great American. I'll talk with Senator Tom Cotton about him at the start of the next hour as well. When a big figure like that leaves the stage, we ought to stop and spend some time reflecting, because not only is it history, it's an admonition both as to successes and failures for those who are presently serving. Senator Cotton served as a soldier under Donald Rumsfeld. He's now in the Senate. In his second term, he's been in the House as well. He's on armed services. We'll talk with him about Don Rumsfeld next. Don't go anywhere, America. It's the Hugh Hewitt Show. I want to remind you that our sponsor is andrewandtodd.com. There with Sierra Pacific, they lend you money to refinance your house or buy a home or help your son or daughter become investors in real estate by becoming a non-occupying co-borrower. They help senior citizens with reverse mortgage. They help veterans with no money down mortgages. They help you refinance. So if you need to get money out of your house or you need a whole new house, go to andrewandtodd.com or call them at 888-888-1172. Canada, I'm Hugh Hewitt. Thank you for listening on this 1st of July, 2021. I'm joined by United States Senator Tom Cotton from the state of Arkansas. Good morning, Senator. How are you?
Good morning, Hugh. Good to be on with you.
I would like you to reflect a little bit on the late Don Rumsfeld, dead at the age of 88 yesterday. You served under him. He was your Secretary of Defense. George W. Bush was your president when you were in combat in Iraq and Afghanistan as a member of the old guard. Maybe Secretary Gates had replaced him by that point. But tell me what you thought about Don Rumsfeld.
Hugh, Don Rumsfeld was a great patriot and a dedicated public servant, dedicated his life to America. You know, straight out of college, he became a naval aviator, and then he was elected to Congress at the young age of 30. The only person to serve as Secretary of Defense twice. And you're right that he was my Secretary of Defense when I started in 2005 and 2006, first for all my training at Fort Benning and then for my tour in Iraq.
As a Secretary of Defense, he had strengths and he had weaknesses. He was very smart. His commentary on known unknowns, I'll play it for you so the audience can understand. The last cut, gentlemen, if you'll play that for Secretary.
There are reports that there is no evidence of a direct link between Baghdad and some of these terrorist organizations.
There are known knowns. There are things we know we know. We also know there are known unknowns. That is to say, we know there are some things we do not know. But there are also unknown unknowns. The ones we don't know, we don't know.
I want to ask Senator Cotton, that is actually very wise. What did you think of that statement?
You know, I know that the media still likes to laugh at that statement, but actually it is a deeply thoughtful way to organize knowledge, whether you're the Secretary of Defense or a young trooper on the front lines or a talk radio host or anyone in business. That just goes to show the kind of deep, rigorous mind that Don Rumsfeld brought to any challenge, whether he was a young congressman, senior executive in the Nixon and Ford White Houses, ambassador to NATO, secretary of defense, or a very accomplished business executive. He was a extremely thorough, methodical thinker, and that's one reason why he was so successful in so many different walks of life.
I've interviewed him a number of times, and I'm going to post two of them at the interview with Hugh Hewitt, the one that I did after his memoir came out, and the one that I did after Rumsfeld Rules came out. But the thing he was most criticized for is actually something he had no responsibility for, the disbanding of the Iraq army, which led to the insurgency. I think as night follows day, I believe that was Ambassador Paul Bremer. Am I right about that, Senator Cotton?
I think you are right, Hugh.
He also was careful to point out he had no control over Gitmo, but he did have control over Abu Ghraib in the line of command. Ought to have resigned after Abu Ghraib's photo came forward. He offered to.
No, Hugh, I don't think so. I know that he did offer to, and President Bush declined it. You know, his successor, Bob Gates, wrote about this in his own books, this time not just Secretary of Defense, but CIA Director and President of Texas A&M. One measure of leadership is not knowing every single thing that is going on in a large, sprawling institution at every single moment, but taking responsibility for what you learn, whether it's in the news, as the Abu Ghraib scandal was for him, or say the Walter Reed scandal was for Bob Gates, or the time that some young airmen inadvertently flew a nuclear-armed missile between Air Force bases in America, taking those things seriously, getting to the bottom of it, holding people accountable.
Let's also talk about some of the downsides of the secretary's second tenure. He was responsible for the littoral combat ship, the Zumwalt destroyer, the Ford aircraft carrier, many questionable decisions. But I think that's probably going to be the case with every secretary of defense. Did he do it more than anybody else? Because with this many weapon systems, you're going to call some wrong. Those are three big strikes, though.
I don't think it was more than any Secretary of Defense. You're right that there's some fits and starts to these programs. One thing they did in both of his tenure as a Secretary of Defense is deal with a military that's on the cusp of change. He came in the 1970s, right after Vietnam, when morale was fairly low and we're transitioning to an all-volunteer force, and he helped lead that transition. And then in 2001, you know, we were a military that's still geared primarily towards fighting a large, heavy mechanized land war against Russia, kind of similar to the war we had fought with great success in 1991, but it was becoming clearer, and I think Secretary Rumsfeld saw this, that future war is going to be either kind of low-intensity, guerrilla-style conflicts that we had fought, that we would fight in Iraq and Afghanistan, or very high-end, primarily air and naval battles against a country like China. So again, he inherited a military that was on the cusp of change.
No, I've thought a lot about Secretary of Defense's because it's such a critical role. It's the biggest department in government. It's the one that's required for our national defense. I think Dick Cheney was a very successful Secretary of Defense. I think Robert Gates was a very successful Secretary of Defense. I think Donald Rumsfeld was very successful in many respects, though not as successful as those two have shorter tenures. But they preceded their time, all three of them, in the elected branches. Cheney and Rumsfeld in the elected branch. Robert Gates at a different agency. Are those prerequisites for being able to run the Department of Defense, prior executive administration or prior legislative ability or perhaps both?
I think they're certainly helpful, Hugh. One thing I've seen in government in my time in Congress over the last few years is it helps to have some kind of governmental experience. So you realize that you're operating in a political environment. The Department of Defense shouldn't be partisan at all, and it's one of the least political cabinet departments, but it's still operating in a political environment. Just to give you one simple example, when two congressional delegations are clashing over which base is going to close or which base is going to get a certain kind of platform assigned to it. So it helps to have either that experience that Vice President Cheney, Secretary Rumsfeld had in the Congress or in the executive branch, or that Bob Gates had rising through the ranks of bureaucracy, the leadership in the CIA, and also notably several stints at the NSC and the White House, too. So I think it helps to have some of that government experience. Obviously, it's not a recipe for or a guarantee for success. We've had secretaries of defense that were in Congress or that had previous executive branch experience and that were not such strong leaders, but I think it really helps.
What about service in the uniform? Secretary Rumsfeld had a lot as a Navy pilot. Now we have General Austin following General Mattis. Good or bad, or it depends?
I think it certainly helps you to understand, in particular at the ground level, what the troopers are thinking. You know, Bob Gates was sometimes referred to as the soldier secretary because he did bring that ground-eye soldier's perspective, having been in the Air Force himself. I mean, I had reservations, as you know, Hugh, about giving yet another waiver to General Austin in January, the second time in just 4 years we granted a waiver to a four-star combatant commander to be our Secretary of Defense. So I'm not sure that the experience of spending 20 or 30 or 40 years in the military brings the full diversity of perspective that a Secretary of Defense needs, but I certainly think it helps to have that experience, as so many of our secretaries have served over the years.
Now, you're also a lawyer. Secretary Rumsfeld told me at the Nixon Library and on this show that the biggest change between his first and second run as SecDef was the number of lawyers. There were 10,000 lawyers in the Pentagon, literally 10,000 lawyers when he returned under George W. Bush. What do you make of that critique and that observation?
Well, first, you, I must respond that it's calumny against me. I am a recovering lawyer. I've now been clean for 16 years, and I do not plan any relapses.
I've only been out there 3 years, but I hope I can go as long as you.
It doesn't surprise me that he had said there are so many lawyers in the Department of Defense. We have too many lawyers in society in general and way too many lawyers in government. Certainly too many lawyers in our Department of Defense. It just goes to show both how needlessly complex and bureaucratic a lot of our management and acquisition processes in the Pentagon have become, and also how over-lawyered our operations are as well.
Last question has to do with a different topic. Yesterday, General Milley told a congressional hearing that there is no chance, not no chance, very unlikely and very little motivation for the People's Republic of China on this, the 100th anniversary of the Chinese Communist Party, to assault Taiwan in the near term. Quote, there's no reason to do it militarily, and they know that. So I think the probability is probably low in the immediate near-term future. Your reaction, Senator Cotton?
Well, I think that's right. Up through the end of the Beijing Olympics in February, Russia didn't invade Crimea in the 8 months before the Sochi Olympics in 2014. They invaded it 4 days after those Olympics ended. But once those Olympics are behind us, the commanders of Pacific Command, both the previous and the current one, have said that China may be considering doing this in 5 years. And frankly, I think they have the capability to do so today, unlike, times 10, 20, 30 years ago. So right now, the only real constraint on Xi Jinping's ambition is what he thinks he can get away with and what he thinks Joe Biden will do in response. And that's why I think we need to be crystal clear that we won't stand for China to try to invade and annex Taiwan.
Senator Tom Cotton, thank you so much for your time. I'll be right back, America. Go nowhere. You're listening to The Hugh Hewitt Show. Welcome back, America. I'm Hugh Hewitt. Inside the Beltway on this 1st of July, 2021. Always happy to welcome back Dan Balz. He's the senior political correspondent for The Washington Post. He's the senior fellow at the Harvard Institute of Politics. I think he's going to actually have to go in the building this year. He's also a veteran of the United States Army, so I want to talk to him first about Secretary Rumsfeld, who I bet he's written more than a few articles about. Good morning, Dan. How are you?
I'm good, Hugh. How are you?
Good. You are a veteran, so I know you follow the SecDef closely, though your beat is national politics. What did you think of Rummy?
Well, Hugh, I didn't have that many encounters with him. Because my beat was politics, I didn't intersect with him that much. The only time I really intersected with him was in the post-9/11 period. Bob Woodward and I were doing a long series on the 10 days after 9/11, and we were interviewing literally every senior official in the Bush administration about what had happened day by day, hour by hour. And we went to the Pentagon to see Secretary Rumsfeld, and we posed a question about a particular meeting that had taken place and some things that he had said, and he reared up in the way that Donald Rumsfeld could do.
Yeah.
And said, how do you, who are you to say, basically this paraphrase, who are you to say what I said in a meeting? And Tory Clark, who was the press person at the Pentagon at that point, said to him, Mr. Secretary, they have pretty good sources on these things. he backed off a little bit, but he was, he was always willing to be combative with the press.
Goodness. Yes.
It was part of his DNA. So I think Hugh, this will date me. I think I first came across him when I was a summer intern back in the mid 60s in the office of Congressman John B. Anderson, who was the congressman in the district where I grew up. And Rumsfeld was then a young House member from Illinois. And so that was the first time I got a look at him and then watched his career, go from there.
Yeah, I'll date myself as well. He began in D.C. as a legislative assistant to Congressman Denny Dennison, who represented Warren, Ohio. And my dad was, ask Denny, he'll get you a gig with Rumsfeld when he was, working in the Nixon administration. I was looking for a summer job. It's really quite an amazing career that represents sort of old Washington. People stayed and rose, Dan Balls, in old Washington. Now they come and go. Is that a fair generalization?
Somewhat fair generalization. I mean, I think you can watch. I think there's still some of that. I mean, if you look at some of the people who are in the Biden administration right now, some of them would follow that pattern. I mean, they've been in and out of government over a number of Democratic administrations. I think what was interesting about Rumsfeld was that he'll be remembered as, person who was Secretary of Defense twice, and frankly, he'll be remembered for what happened with Iraq. That's a major part of his legacy. But the variety of positions that he held, whether it was in Congress or the poverty program, twice at Secretary of Defense, the White House, it was a varied career. It wasn't one in which he sort of picked one particular lane, which is to say he started in the Defense Department as a junior aide and rose eventually to become secretary. He had a career that defied that kind of path.
But yeah, Dan, do you need a project? I have a project to suggest to you.
Okay.
I think you're uniquely positioned to write about Washington, D.C. friendships. That last, he is friends with Dick Cheney, and everyone should know that. They had houses together at the shore next to each other. They're just deep and longtime friends. You mentioned Woodward, working with Woodward. I know he's been your friend, Bob, for a long, long time. There are unique friendships in Washington, D.C. I think of Fred Fielding and the ace golfer, scratch golfer, Dick Houser, who was his deputy in the White House. I there's just a book out there about, Walter Isaacson wrote with our friend Evan Thomas, Wise Men, but they were in and out of. I mean, friendships in D.C. are not that common, are they? That extend over decades.
They may be more common than we think. Although, I don't know how much of them are in government. I mean, Hugh, I think one of the things that's happened is that people are in government, and then they kind of go into the private sector, but it's quasi-governmental private sector, People can hang around Washington for a very long time, and those friendships probably exist. But the friendships of people who have been, who started out as young people, men or women, having entry level jobs or first jobs on Capitol Hill or first jobs in administration, and remain both active in government or in Washington, activities. Over the years, I suspect there are a fair number of those. I'll take that under advisement, Hugh.
I left in 1988 and I came back in 2016. So that's almost 30 years, and it's a very different place. But there are some friendships that endure. Now, Dan, I want to turn to your last story, the most recent story, not your last story. Goodness, no. In the Washington Post. No final stories from Dan Balls. They're never going to let you go, you're going to have to work forever. The story about the bipartisan bill, I've talked now to a number of people, Tim Scott, members of the House, members of the Senate, on and off the record. It's dead, 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 dead because of what President Biden said 2 hours after he left. And the only way it comes back is if it passes the House first and gets sent over to the Senate, because it will not get 60 votes because of what the president did. What's your understanding of what happened there? Because he killed it 2 hours after he blessed it.
Hugh, I wish I knew the real story. I don't know the real story of what happened. I can't conclude whether it was a deliberate statement on his part to send a signal to the left, or it was simply a mistake on his part, a garbled use of language. Because in the prepared statement, he only talked about these moving in tandem, and I think everybody understood that there was going to be a bipartisan bill and there was going to be a reconciliation bill. Republicans and Democrats understood that, including the members of the bipartisan group of 10 senators. They all knew that that was the plan. What alarmed the Republicans, obviously, was that in one way or another, the fate of them was tied together. In other words, that they were on two tracks for a while, but eventually they all ended up on the same track. And if they didn't both reach the station, neither was going to reach the station. Pardon my metaphors, but my sense is that Biden overspoke. But I hesitate to draw that conclusion firmly because of what Speaker Pelosi had done earlier in the day when she was very blunt about, as she put it, there ain't going to be one without the other. And so I don't know whether he was influenced by that. And then when he got the question from one of the reporters about them moving in tandem, and he said, you know, if this is the only thing I get, I won't sign it. I don't know, Hugh, you may be onto it more than I am. I don't know that this is definitely dead. The reason I say that is, I talked to Mark Warner the morning after the agreement, and the first thing he said is, which I put in the Sunday piece, usually we get a day to celebrate these kinds of things. We got 2 hours. but the last thing he said was, have you ever seen one of these that doesn't have multiple twists and turns before we get to the end of it? And so I think that given the amount of time, given the negotiating the Democrats are going to have to do to determine what the shape and size and details of that reconciliation package look like, I think we're still a ways away in which things could happen. And I think that the bipartisan group of senators is now back on board on the idea that they want to get this done. And we'll see if they are able to, persuade enough other Republicans in the Senate to get it passed.
Couple of comments. The first is a general one. Dan began his answer. This is for young people out there. I always say when I talk to young people, there are 8 most important words in the English language is, I know a guy, and have you ever considered? I'm going to make it 11 and add Dan's first 3. I don't know. If people just said, I don't know more often, the life would be a lot. So he doesn't know. I don't know either. I know what Republican senators have told me, which is they're not buying this unless it comes out of the House first. Because of the linkage that was not part. Their assumption was this: there were two trains. One train was going to run through, was the Acela, and that was the bipartisan bill. And the other was the local, which may or may not get to D.C. And they just were not tied together. The linkage killed it. But you're right. If the House passes it, the infrastructure bill, and they know what needs to be in it, Joe Biden agreed to it. If they pass that, it'll pass the Senate. If they're asked to passing it first, there just aren't 10 votes, I am told. Let me close by asking you about what President Trump said last night to Sean Hannity. Can we play? Sean asked him, have you made up your mind about running in 2024? And Donald Trump says this, cut 23, just the start of it.
Have you made up your mind?
Yes.
Well, then, Dan Balls, Sean does not ask the next question, which makes me a little bit crazy.
Well, what's wrong with Sean?
I don't know. Maybe they had an agreement, but I mean, it's sort of like who shot JR. What do you draw from that?
That whatever he has decided, he could change his mind.
Well put. I just couldn't believe it. Ask him, Sean, ask him. And no, it's season 5 of the Trump show, or season 6
right.
Is coming up.
They're going to drag that out for months.
It gets ratings. It gets the rest of cable's dead and Sean's alive. Let me close by asking you in terms of other candidates. You've been around D.C. a long time. I don't see the other candidates stopping because Donald Trump hasn't said yay or nay. Do you?
No, I don't. I don't see that at all. I mean, and I think it would not be in their interest or the Republican Party's interest to have people simply stand aside and wait for the former president to make up his mind. I mean, there, you know, the future of the Republican Party is in flux, and there are any number of people who I think want to be a part of shaping that, whether the former president is a candidate or completely on the sidelines. And so they can't, you know, they can't make their decisions in the anticipation of something that he might or might not do.
Let me clarify what Dan said. He did not say the future of the Republican Party is in Fox. He said it's in flux. I want to make sure that people understand that. Flux. Dan Balz, always a pleasure. Have a great 4th of July, Dan. Follow him on Twitter at Dan Balz, the Dean of Washington, D.C. Journalism, and justly so.